I went into a bank and was given a list of people that they were trying to fire for over a year.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast with Jerry, Mario, and Sunil. Thanks as always, guys, for joining. Good to see you.
Good seeing you as well. Hey. Good to be here.
All right, guys. So let's launch right in. As always, there seems to be a never-ending stream of things to talk about in cybersecurity. And you know, one of the first things that we were going to talk about is this report about, it was an academic paper about a lot of malicious extensions detected in Chrome. I thought this was worth talking about, not because of the academic paper, but to me, this triggers a lot of discussion I think is really important about the modern enterprise and unmanaged browsers and BYOD and whether or not everybody's kind of the Wild West, you know, out there. So, you know, first of all, have you guys been in this situation where you allow people to install extensions in Chrome or try to police that successfully?
Yeah, at Bank of America, we definitely paid attention to this because, in effect, we saw the browser as the new operating system. And with that in mind, we are going to, if we don't see it in that way, we're going to repeat the mistakes of the past. And we're starting to cycle through those mistakes and come up with corrective controls now. Like, very first thing that we did was just have an inventory. It's sort of like saying, when you have Windows, what's your inventory of applications? Then we go through the process of saying what's approved, not approved. Eventually, the technology is going to emerge, if it hasn't already emerged, and to some degree it has, where there's checks, hash-based checks to see if these if certain extensions are good or bad. And we certainly would want to rely upon Google and or Chrome, you know, the whole ecosystem to help us find those malicious things. But yeah, it's repeating the cycle of the past, which is treat the browser as a new OS, and all the patterns that we've seen in the past will repeat itself again.
Yeah, no, we've used to allow extensions in our browsers at other companies that I've been at. You know, a lot of the problems stems from employees using the company browsers for personal use as well, right? Yeah. And so if you have folks in the marketing team or in the development team, they want some of these extensions because they want to make themselves efficient. They want to make their jobs efficient. And I completely understand that and appreciate it. But just like Sunil mentioned, these browsers are operating systems. And ask yourself a question, would you install every known application that's posted out there on the internet? Mm-hmm. On your work laptop or even your home laptop? That's a question I ask all of us. I think it's hard to manage if you go from a culture where you let everybody put extensions for personal use as well, and then you start trying to reduce their usage. It becomes a really big pyrrhic big victory.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the challenges that we also have with browser-based extensions is that they remain persistent, especially if you use browsers and you save your browser profile and reuse that browser profile on other machines. And I'm pretty confident that if you have a malicious extension, it'll keep those sessions, if you will, and move them over to the other machine as well. And this is really a really great opportunity for info stealers to step in and scoop up a lot of content wherever you go. So wherever you end up with that browser extension, it's not just the browser that may be affected, but other parts of the ecosystem that browser is actually in.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot, like my background being in a big Fortune financial services company, and you used the example of Bank of America, Sunil, but then there's this massive long tail. I wouldn't call it a long tail. It's like the rest of the spectrum of companies out there that don't have the level of managed devices. And I think the companies being born today are all BYOD and onward. So, you know, that's an area I've been exploring a lot lately, talking to smaller companies without security shops. And I think the average layperson or lay organization has no control over this at all. Chrome is out there. If you have a managed device, you basically have maybe a serial number or a bespoke registry thing to say, like, it's ours, we paid for it. But then when you dig into, like, okay, so what does that buy you? What's the difference? Well, nothing. Whether it's local admin or, in this case, browser extensions. So having dug into this a bit, I think what the average IT or you know, intro security person needs to know is, you know, one, in Chrome, you can, in essence, whitelist extensions. You can do that. Yeah, and you can do it in a monitor mode so you can see what's out there first. There's a couple of tools out there, some free ones. And then you could start by saying, okay, let's allow everybody to run the stuff they ran yesterday, and then, you know, kind of stop the bleeding on anything new, and then slowly go back and go through all those extensions to see what's good or bad. But an interesting, like, so I'm, full disclosure, I'm an investor in, an advisor to Island, a managed, enterprise browser platform. And there's the other big competitor is Talon, so let's go ahead and throw them both out there, and I think they both do
Palo Alto now.
Sorry, yeah, Palo Alto owns Talon now. What's really interesting is if you think about, like, what can a bad extension do? It can do what the browser can do. So it can get anything that browser can get to. And so I see so if you go and you have managed Chrome and you say it can only have these extensions, it only counts if the person's logging into Chrome, because then they're going to inherit the management. If they're running a one-off Chrome or something at home, it's not going to matter. But what's interesting to think about is you only have to protect the browser that is allowed to get to the enterprise apps. If an employee has a browser that could get to all your sensitive data and you're keeping it super sparkly clean, and over on next to it they're running old school Chrome with all kinds of malware, one might argue, who cares? Because if you can't get to Salesforce with that other browser because you're locking it to your enterprise browser, then you kind of get to throw your hands up about that and say, yeah, you go ahead, salesperson, do everything you want. But when you try to add an extension for Salesforce, which is our data, we're going to slap your hand. We're going to block you there.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And Chrome has done a lot to, the Google/Chrome team has done a lot to enforce isolation across different sessions or even within different tabs. But that's it is something that the crossover is really the concern that happens when someone logs into a corporate resource without necessarily having that resource perform things like conditional access, where it says, okay, I can only lock it down to this browser, this corporate browser that we're using. And there's so many corporate apps that we use where that is oftentimes the case, and we don't have that conditional access ability for that SaaS application itself.
You know, I've another experience that I've had with these extensions. My previous red team loved installing, you know, their own extensions on our when we were doing some renting activities internally. Now, look, this might be it's a year ago, so it might be a little stale. So I don't want to misrepresent anything that CrowdStrike or Sentinel does today or do, but. Normally, at least 12 months ago, you could put an extension on a Chrome and do a lot of badness, and the CrowdStrikes and the Sentinels of the world were practically blind. And so the red teams loved extensions for that matter.
Yeah, and one of the other things that we're seeing, and I think we already seen with this with some of the app blockers, and there's a lot of fake lookalike ones. So just as much as we've had lookalike malware that looks like it's or lookalike domains or whatever else it is, well, we're already seeing a bunch of lookalike extensions being published. This then points to the need for, you know, some sort of community review and, you know, ratings and so on and so forth. And that's certainly a concern. And then the other general concern is co-opting existing extensions. And we've seen this already with open source software. We should definitely expect to see that with extensions as well.
Yeah, you know, I think when you think about the majority of companies out there, browser extensions and whether or not they're causing actual harm in mass or if this threat vector is being employed much or not, I think that's less important on its own, but it's co-symptomatic with a much more prevalent problem, which is the widespread adoption of SaaS platforms and no restriction on where you can get to them from. I think if you take the average G Suite customer, Google Workspace customer, they allow their employees to access G Drive from home. And, you know, whether you're an adversary who penetrated the home computer and you're writing a session or something like that, or whether you're a rogue employee or whether you're just, you know, someone's kid who's using their computer, if you can just pop in the drive and get to everything that's corporate, that's just such a bigger issue to me. And I think that's a threat vector that a lot of companies don't think about right away. And then they're trying to buy data leakage prevention tools, and they're trying to look through emails and uploads dynamically for social security numbers and all this really data-centric approach. And it seems ridiculous to me. I mean, the low-hanging fruit that you have to go after is, can you log into your enterprise-approved SaaS apps from an unmanaged device and click the download button and export stuff out of Salesforce, out of ServiceNow, out of Workday, and on and on? And if so, then you need to ask yourself, am I okay with that? Is this data really not a big deal? Because the answer might be yes. We need to give room for that. But if you don't like that, then before you go and you're buying a bunch of tools, you need to just figure out, how do I make that impossible? All right, changing gears here. So the cybersecurity job market, man, this is an interesting topic. I think you guys are probably in the same boat as me, where you constantly get these kind of dueling narratives about there's not enough people out there for cybersecurity jobs, and then you hear the, hey, I'm trying to get into cybersecurity and no one will answer my calls or take my resumes, and there's no jobs out there. Is that right? Is that what you hear?
Definitely get a lot of people who are entering into the market that don't have the skills to qualify, per se. But I don't know. I think that's a good thing in some respects. At the same time, it's a symptom of a bigger problem, which is, and this is the way I characterize it is, I think I've, for those who know me, I talk about this notion of pets and cattle, which is we tend to adopt a lot of pets, things that require lots of security, versus building systems that are more like cattle that don't require security at all. And the cattle should be built to be distributed, immutable, and ephemeral, or DIE. Anyway, so in this narrative, what I oftentimes talk about or lament is the fact that we don't have enough veterinarians, okay? And that's the, you know, that's why there's a huge job market. We don't have enough veterinarians. But maybe the bigger problem is we're not doing enough pet control.
Too many pets?
We have too many pets, right. So how do we avoid adopting more and more pets? And if we can focus on that, actually, above trying to secure everything, then we don't actually need as many veterinarians. We don't need as many cybersecurity practitioners. Do we need more cybersecurity practitioners? Yes. Do we need as many as we do now? I think, again, symptomatic of a larger problem, which is we keep adopting more pets.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, when I read this article as well, they pointed out, they pointed that there was a proliferation of SaaS applications as well. And every SaaS application, they're great. They really can help productivity, accelerate entry into market that your company hasn't been there before, et cetera. But they also come with a price. Who's monitoring them? Who's looking out for any issues happening there? How do you configure these SaaS applications as well? And, you know, having 10, 20 might be manageable for pets. But when you have 400 pets, that becomes really difficult. Yes, there are companies who specialize in doing security for all of these different SaaS applications, but still, it's a very challenging place to be, because you're just getting a lot more pets, Sunil. There's just, I don't see it. Yeah.
And let's be clear, it's not 400 dogs. It's a dog and a cat and a mouse and a giraffe and a pig and a sheep.
That's right.
And you're like, okay, is there one, do you know how to take care? You may know how to take care of a dog or a cat. Do you know how to take care of a sheep? Right.
It's like Sunil's arc.
That's right.
Sunil, let me test the metaphor and see if I get it right. So, you know, how do you transform pet into cattle? Let's take very specific ones: ServiceNow and Asana or something like that. And you're right. If you want to be an expert at securing those, you could dedicate a career to one of them, right? And I think it's completely untenable for a company to hire the 400 experts. And I've always said, like, if you have a product description in a title, then you're doing something wrong from like labor management. So you should never hire a ServiceNow administrator. That's a stupid job, right? So my kind of brutal old NetSec guy solution to this is, well, I think you should take ServiceNow off the internet, or you should whitelist it to your office IPs, or you should require using an enterprise browser to egress it through a certain area and lock it down to that, with the thought that you're never going to configure it right. It's going to be sloppy. It's going to be a mess. But I'm not going to care because it's not running on your mother-in-law's PC and you're not accidentally downloading all the data to it and whatnot. Is that turning it into cattle, or is there something, a different approach?
Well, first of all, going from pets to cattle is actually really hard. You don't really go backwards. Once you have Betsy, your cow, turn into... once you have Betsy, the cattle, or rather... XQZ L5 turn into Betsy the cow, you don't go back to, oh, calling it XQZ whatever whatever, it's now Betsy my pet cow. And the way you go from cattle, from pets to cattle, is not by renaming it, but rather by shooting it and eating it for dinner. So it's a very, you know, it's not something that people are necessarily inclined to do, and so going backwards is really hard. What you want to focus on is, how do you avoid even being in that situation to begin with? And when it comes to SaaS-based applications, I think one of the things that we as enterprises or practitioners want to do is always have a strategy for, if ServiceNow became defunct as an organization, or we wanted to pivot off of them, how have you thought about a transition path off of that platform? Mm-hmm. And that is a very cattle-like thinking. ServiceNow, as far as I'm concerned, is cattle, and I may use it today, but tomorrow I may want to use something else. It requires a lot of forethought, but that's the way to think, approach it like cattle.
You know, as Jerry was talking about also IP whitelisting some of these SaaS applications to restrict it only to your network. I mean, just using Sunil's analogy of a cattle, you know, when you get cattle, it's not just the cattle themselves. You're going to get birds on top of those cattle, feeding off whatever bugs those cattle have. Mm. So you have an ecosystem. So oftentimes things like, as an example, Salesforce, not that there's anything, just Salesforce as an example.
Sure.
You know, so yeah, you lock down your network to your network, but then you have vendors who are using your, you have vendors who then connect to your Salesforce to support it. They become conduits for data exfiltration, potentially also for compromising your Salesforce account as well. How do you block that? Even if you block it, you have all these vendors, these cattle comes with a lot of different birds and animals that are supporting cats. You just can't just say cattle, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is a whole ecosystem that you have to account for, and that's the challenge. I think to some degree, this is where I would want to rely upon the vendors to help out here as well, because... let me just attach it back to a different conversation around the extensions or malicious Chrome extensions. Each application that we have also have their own set of plugins to other applications. And those plugins, I mean, they're transferring lots of data back and forth. And do we really have an understanding of what those plugins are actually doing for us? Could somebody insert a malicious plugin, or, you know, an insider actually incorporate a malicious app that siphons off data? Of course, yes. So those are things that it's a whole other ecosystem. It's another whole OS as well that we need to now account for.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, like I said, IP whitelisting to apps, and like I'm still of the mind that you need to count on your SaaS apps being poorly configured. You need to bank on that and still have a plan to win, because your plan can't be to chase them all down and get them all tweaked just right. It will not work. I threw out IP whitelisting. Well, I guess the real model today is actually IDP control. You know, I think people have done a pretty good job, driven by convenience more than security, of harmonizing on IDPs for logging in as SaaS apps. And now, like, if you say, well, how do I restrict ServiceNow, Salesforce, to my IPs? The answer is, well, you do it at the IDP. You don't let somebody auth into the IDP, or when they do, they can't get access to that particular app unless they're in a certain area. Which is good. I mean, it gives us some hope.
But can see this is all complicated, though, Jerry, right? I mean, this is why this is fueling the boom in cybersecurity jobs. This is like just it's getting more and more complicated. And I was reading an article on Dice. Yes, Dice.com. I can't believe they still have something out there for some of us. I'm dating myself. Okay. So anyway, the article mentioned that there is so much. They did a survey of cybersecurity folks today, in the last 12 months, and just the burnout is real. So you get a lot of burnout. People are just, they're under a lot of stress. 60% of cybersecurity employees stated that they were burned out, that they were working late hours, and they just didn't see a light at the end of the tunnel. So you got that with the cybersecurity booming jobs. You can see there's a need for these jobs. I don't think it's going to get any smaller.
Yeah, you know, I on the burnout thing, I feel like, you know, we're wrong if we think people are getting these cyber jobs, and then they have a list of 400 apps to configure, and they make it into number three by the evening, and they're supposed to be going home for dinner, and instead they're working on four and five, and they're configuring, and that's why they're burnout. I don't think that's what's happening. I think what's happening is they're running into bureaucracy and red tape, poor leadership, thrown in a bunch of different directions. They're told to work on the SaaS apps. They go to talk to the SaaS administrators. They work from someone who's driven more from the sales side. They're not responding to their emails. It's cultural burnout. I don't think it's technological or workload.
Well, let me also offer those. It's a bit more of a challenge, especially when it comes to SaaS applications, because who is the SaaS administrator? Mm-hmm. In many organizations, that's the business side. Mm-hmm. And it's the people who brought the SaaS application in because they're trying to perform some business function. Of course, usually these folks have no idea what matters from a security standpoint. And as you come in and say, oh, you know what, let me revoke these permissions. It looks like we're not adhering to least privileges. Can I revoke these admin rights from so-and-so and so-and-so? And they say, oh, okay, sure, you revoke it. And the next day, people are in uproar because now they can't actually get their job done anymore. Yeah. Understanding which permissions were necessary and which weren't, and
that's the burnout.
It's hard, yeah. but let me offer it. The burnout is happening because we're being thrown into a job for which we don't actually have domain expertise.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely see that all the time. Meaning you don't understand Salesforce the way the business user does.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go back to the veterinarian example. You've taken care of dogs all your life, and now you're being asked to take care of giraffe, and you're like, okay.
Yeah.
But I would argue even the Salesforce administrators or the ServiceNow administrators don't even know their application as well either.
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, this goes back to the CIS benchmarking and hardening mm-hmm. guides, right? You remember 20 years ago, all the rage, all that security was the hardening guides. Mm-hmm. Well, what OS do you have? Windows 2003. Oh, and then the auditor, the examiner, whoever it was, came out with the hardening guide. Have you followed the hardening guide? And we all hired a lot of people and burnt a lot of shareholder value on following the hardening guides. Some of us succeeded, some don't, but we can't tell the difference because it had no correlation to who's getting owned and who's not. Either you took the damn system off the internet and you won, or you didn't and you lost. And the hardening had nothing to do with that. Right? And then for anybody who played that game deep enough, right, it pivoted from operating systems into there was a Postgres, there was the MySQL hardening guide. Right? And so there was these app level ones. And I haven't looked lately, and I don't even want to, but there either is or is an analog of, I bet, a Salesforce hardening guide now, right? And probably every SaaS app has a hardening guide.
SSPM. That's where SSPMs come in.
Well, I don't think that's the answer. Like, I don't think it's, oh, well, we need to publish a new, you know, Cloud Security Alliance hardening guide on app X, on Notion, and now what are you going to do? You're going to hire someone to follow the guide. You got to watch the guide's going to be updated. You got to get these things off the internet.
Man, I'm going to poke holes on that. Sorry,
please.
Sunil.
Yeah, it's a controversial stance. Yeah, I know.
Go ahead, Sunil. Go ahead.
This goes to the conversation we had about shared fate, where the SaaS provider has to provide some guidance and tools and make that super easy for users as well.
MFA, IP whitelisting, all these things that are, you know, recommended with CIS. You know, you hear them in the headlines. If you're not using MFA, you're gonna expose yourself unnecessarily on the internet. And I also agree with IP whitelisting. I think IP whitelisting is also very useful in combination. So I think where the problem with CIS is that we took it, some people, some organizations took it as the end all. It is the beginning of a journey. It was meant to say, dude, these are the most basic things. If you're struggling with these most basic things, we got some issues, okay, folks? But once you address the CIS benchmarks, there's more things you got to go get done. That's just the entry level, man.
Well, you'll never address them either.
Well, yeah, but hold on. Let me push back on that, because let me be adversarial. Because if you recall, on the hardening guides that we had with Windows, what the very first thing that happened if you follow the hardening guides is everything broke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right?
So in the same way, if you go and use CIS benchmarks and lock down, you know, so-and-so app, people would just say, I can't use this app anymore. So right. So the question is, what's the right balance? If the benchmarks truly are benchmarks in the sense of you should always do these things, then at that point, there's really no benchmark to have, because at that point, the SaaS application should just make that a default option.
That's right. MFA is a good candidate.
Yeah, well, possibly, but I'll give you an example. For those who recall way back in the day, like right around COVID, Zoom had a setting that was toggleable around do I allow people to be able to just jump into Zoom without a key, right, or a passcode. Well, that option is not something that you can toggle off anymore. It's even though it's kind of weird, if you go into Zoom and the Zoom settings, it looks like you can toggle the option, but they've basically just said, sorry, you're not going to be able to change the option anymore. All right, that is not a benchmark anymore. It's just like a standard setting that everyone's going to have to abide by and live with. Would it cause issues? Sure, of course. But at some level, a vendor will say, you know what, this is causing too much harm to make this configurable. We're not going to make it configurable anymore. Too bad. Sure. Move on.
That's fair. Going back to the cybersecurity job market thing, you know, kind of broadly, I did want to talk a little bit. You know, so I'm a professor, right, at Georgia Tech on cybersecurity. I teach a class, Enterprise Cybersecurity Management. So I get a lot of people that hit me up after class, and they're looking for jobs, and they're running into the, I don't have enough experience yet. How do I get experience? And look, I keep on telling them, and I really believe in this, that there's no shortage of free experience available between, I mean, you could put up a lab and try stuff or whatever it may be, for sure. But you also, this bug bounty world, and being able to, you know, I had someone tell me, I said, okay, well, what are your skills? What can you do? And I said, oh, well, you know, pen testing, that's what I do. Okay, great, but I haven't had a hard job at it. I haven't had a specific job, so I don't have experience. I asked if they've done bug bounties. No. How? How could you not? I mean, you got to make an effort. You know, jobs aren't just being handed out here. Now, if you tell me you're doing all that and you're still not getting any bites, then okay, I have more sympathy for it. But I feel like there's a lot of easy, free ways to get some quasi-experience.
Yeah, and I don't know if a bug bounty, it requires, you know, a higher level of skill. But the point I think you're making is that this is a very dynamic field that requires constant learning, and at a evidence that you're constantly learning. And sure, you can go to school, get certified, but I think what a lot of us would want to say, you know what, whatever you learned at university probably is at least a couple years dated. What are you doing now that demonstrates that you're continuing to learn? Because once you get this job, that's going to be the norm.
Yeah. What do you guys think of internships on that topic?
I'm 1,000% in favor of internships. I think over the course of my career, I've hired almost 300-400 interns. So,
yeah. Well, the question comes up, like, what is the true definition? What's the difference in an internship and an hourly work, right? And it gets into a lot of, like, especially with the universities, if you talk about an internship, oh, well, let us bring in an internship program, and there's prerequisites for it, and you have to do this, that, and the other to be officially on the list, and then anyone who's, you know, just trying to leave by dinner time tonight kind of throws their hands up and says, whoa, 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 this is getting too hairy for me. But if it's contract to hire, part-time to full, and you can establish that at a company, I think that's brilliant. And if you open that up to current students, aka interns, yeah, I think that's super valuable. All right. This is a fun topic here. Did you guys see this article about Wells Fargo firing, what do they call, mouse juggler users?
Well, I remember when we first did this, I'm sorry, when we first, anyway, I remember it was because we were trying to avoid the screensaver from kicking in.
That's it. Yep.
Yeah. So
the spreadsheet. Anyway. Remember the spreadsheet? Like you're playing a video game, you go right, it goes into a spreadsheet.
Makes the boss mode.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Right, exactly. Remember that?
That's what it was.
Like, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So reading this article, it would make the layperson believe, I think lay people generally believe that IT and cyber have a lot more visibility into what the hell's going on than in real life. And when I was prepping for this, I thought it'd be cool at a show like an RSA to have a big stage and have on the left someone sitting at a laptop that the audience can see the screen of. And on the right, you have a cyber expert analyst who cannot see the screen but has a full level of it, whatever they ask for in advance, software, the thing's going through a proxy server that's decrypting. They have logs. They could look at that. They have Splunk. They have everything else. And then have that person just start doing stuff, run an Excel, go to a website, and have that person try to explain from a cyber perspective what's going on the desktop. Because it's tough, right? You're flying blind. I don't believe Wells Fargo knows exactly what's going on and had software monitoring exactly where the mice was moving and all that. I think it's easy to misunderstand this. I'm guessing it was either a mouse jiggler to make the password not kick in or to make the little green light show in Slack and Teams that they're online. And that's probably as sophisticated as this gets. So the bigger question that comes up here is productivity monitoring. I would bet what's going on here is, well, let me not speculate about Wells Fargo. We all have friends there, et cetera. But I have experience where the culture of a company makes it impossible to fire someone. And so in that environment, any kind of hard borderline criminal evidence, hard policy violations is gold dust. Right? I went into a bank and was given a list of people that they were trying to fire for over a year. And said, here, all these people we want to fire, but we can't. And I said, okay, cool, let's fire them. So no, can't. And then I was told anyone who issues a complaint to HR cannot be fired. Full on. That's just it. In environments like that, the managers of those problem people would love something like, oh, we have an anti-mouse jiggler policy and hard evidence they violate it. Let's fire them. I'm thinking that's more likely what's going on here.
Yeah, or rather, it's not a anti-jiggler technology, but rather circumvention of security controls. So one security control is timeout and locking the machine. Hey, it appears that you're doing something that avoids this from happening. I don't really care why you might have that in place, but you're clearly violating a security policy and you get to axe. It's very similar to all these laws that are in books where someone pulls you over and the police says, oh, you got some violation that you've never heard about, and you get arrested for that sort of thing. It's in the books because of exactly the kind of scenario that you're looking for. It's a reason to prosecute you in some way.
On a technical note, I went through this, I remember. I don't think it was pandemic. I think it was pre-pandemic, but it was remote work, and we had a mouse jiggler epidemic. Maybe not an epidemic. Maybe there was 20 people or something, but I forget how we caught wind or why we caught wind of it initially. It was for the password thing. Oh, it was because we had a five-minute password. There you go. So you have a five-minute password policy. All of a sudden, you give rise to this world of people trying to get around it. And we found it by device ID. There was some device IDs. It was Windows devices. There was a event log that was generated when devices were added. We jammed that all into a SEM and parsed through it and were accurately able to nail some mouse jiggle users. I suppose that's what was going on here as well. Otherwise, how do you even detect this stuff?
You know, two things came up. When I read this, two things were very clear to me. One, it reminded me of my own experiences at other companies where, keyboard monitoring, keyboard logging, keyboard monitoring, it was a really, really emotional topic for employees. And I'm just going to say from a security perspective, folks, just like what Jerry said, I have zero interest in looking at what you're typing on your keyboards. My job is to do security, not to be spying on our own employees. It's just way too much stuff happening. Billions and billions and billions of activities happening by every employee and multiplied by all those employees in a company for me to be making sense of that. It's not useful. Okay. So this, I felt it's also very counterproductive in my opinion to do this, to have that kind of a culture. But at the same time, this was the second point. I when I read the article, I noticed that the team was a wealth management team, and I was like, oh my goodness, I hope my wealth management team is not doing this. Not that I do any business with Wells Fargo, but anyway.
That's your disclaimer.
Well, yes. you might be doing business with them, you just don't know, because anyway.
I'm sorry. Yes, that's right. I'm buying the portfolios through somebody else.
That's right. there was something that Jerry mentioned, and I wonder if there's a one could argue that the managers of these people are almost just as at fault as well.
Mm-hmm.
If your team is driven to having to simulate activity just to look busy, that's a different problem that needs to be addressed. But let me also then say, let's go back to the question about security controls. If someone's trying to circumvent a security control because it's disrupting their ability to get job done, then the fault lies in the security control, not the person that's trying to circumvent it.
I agree with you. I think that's something people don't say enough, right? We should self-reflect here and say, what's going on? Because they're trying to generate revenue.
Yes, they're trying to get their job done. And one of the things that was also quite instructive and one that I would strongly encourage people to do is when you see somebody intentionally violating a security control, or maybe not even intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, it's worth asking them and saying, what was the job that you were trying to perform? And why, you know, they'll tell you this was what I was trying to do. And what you'll find is that the security control ended up being a barrier to being able to get that done.
Yeah. A good example of that, very relevant to this, the mouse jiggler and the keyboard timeout. I remember getting a complaint from people about the 5-minute timeout and whatnot. And then I visited this facility we had put together that was public facing. It was actually in a mall. It was a trading center. That sounds kind of weird, but we were closing a futures trading floor, moving people into this trading center. And so we had these screens that were showing futures market prices live, and you could walk by the gap, and then you could see the price of natural gas, which might be something you're interested in. You can think of it like a ticker. And I walked by, and the screen was locked. And it was humiliating. And that's when the local guys were very gracious and said, yeah, this is what we were trying to tell you. Yeah, you know what you see. And to your exact point, we said, how do we solve this? And I remember the solution, by the way, was kiosk accounts. Creating very limited kiosk accounts that could just display the thing, had zero screensaver protections on them, and boom. So there's always a way. All right, now it's a segment in the show where we talk about ransomware. We could have that a standing segment, right? Yeah.
All right, I'm not saying it's about Russia, but it's about Russia.
Yeah, attribution's one thing. Look, when I think about ransomware, and we have a string of ransomware incidents, again, that people are interested in, I keep beating my drum about banning ransom payments. I still feel like that has to happen. And let me put it this way for you. If you take away ransom payments, I mean, do we even have a cybersecurity industry? I mean, if you take away ransomware-related events, I think that we have a fraction of the interest in this whole world in cybersecurity, sadly enough.
But not everything's driven by money in some cases. I mean, especially if it's a nation state behind it. Maybe what they're trying to do is disrupt services, right?
Yeah.
So there's no money associated with that. Maybe they're affiliated to a government as well. Some of these folks are affiliated with the governments. And they're just there to, you know, the money is the side effect. It's not the primary reason, at least when it's coming from a nation state.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with Putin basically kind of throwing down the gauntlet recently, saying, hey, essentially, without saying it explicitly, Russia's adversary's critical infrastructure is fair game, essentially. Okay. Well, what counts as critical infrastructure for us, healthcare, you know, hospitals, whatever else it is, and there this notion of saying go have a and other critical, you know, energy sector, whatever, have fun. What I think is really fascinating about this new development, it's not totally a new development because it's already been happening for a while, is that we've said for a long time that around what constitutes declaring war when the effects primarily reside just in the cyberspace. Uh-huh. And for a long time during COVID, when attackers attacked hospitals, many hospitals were like, well, we haven't had any patient deaths directly due to ransomware, so ransomware wasn't the cause. But we all know what's happened. Patient care has definitely degraded, and people have died as a result, if not directly, certainly very closely indirectly. And so with the NHS attack just recently, which has Russian fingerprints all over it, how much further do we need to go before we start saying this is an act of war?
That's interesting. If you look at orthogonal to what you're saying is, there's extortion has a data extortion these days, and then it has an availability extortion, which is the more classic version of it. And I would argue that the availability extortion is the thing that bridges over into the kinetic impact here over and over again. And so if you took that away, like the NHS attacks as recently as, just here in June, nobody cared about the idea that, sorry, I shouldn't say nobody cared, but the threat of, hey, they're going to disclose all this patient data and NHS ID numbers and all of that, national health ID numbers, pales in comparison to people can't have procedures, right? And people can't actually go into the hospital. But either way, and if you take the extortion out of the data theft, so if you think about data theft incidents that were not for extortion, it brings us back to the old Equifax days, right? And that just, to me, was the impact of the Equifax breach on the average person is just nothing compared to these ransomware breaches and NHS and whatever it may be. So I just feel like that extortion is the difference.
So if you consider ransomware as an attack form, and you tie it back to the CIA triad, confidentiality, integrity, and availability, what's fascinating about it is that it hits all three, right? Mm-hmm. The type of attacks that we're seeing hits confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And the reason why that's also interesting is different industries have different priorities among those three key components of confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So, for example, financial services, correct me if I'm wrong, but the number one thing that we really, really, really care about above everything else is integrity. Okay. Do we care about confidentiality and availability too? Yes, we do. But integrity is perhaps the foremost thing that we care about. And maybe for other industries, it's availability, and for other industries, it's confidentiality. I'm not saying all three aren't important, but one certainly typically rises above all the others. Well, with ransomware, it hits all three. And attackers will definitely use that to their advantage and say, with one type of attack, we'll make this particular part that you care about the most painful part of your existence or this attack. So you care a lot about availability, we'll make that unavailable. Mm-hmm. You care about integrity, we'll make it corrupted, right? Whatever it is that causes the most pain.
Yeah. So do you guys think it's untenable to get to a place where we ban ransom payments, or do you just think it would be not effective enough to be worth the downside?
I think So going back to the question of what constitutes cyber war, I think that's going to be something that really needs to be further explored and understood and established. I know these red lines that we have keep changing and shifting, and we're not even sure if we know how to label it. But you could, let's take the NHS attack, which has disrupted like almost 1,000 medical operations and such. Okay, so we're likely going to have patient deaths as a result of that. How many patient deaths are enough? One? 500? At what point is there going to be some clear retaliatory consequences because of this attack? that's, well, to me, ransomware is one thing. I mean, sorry, paying the ransom is one thing. Another thing is you created a kinetic outcome on our end. Well, what do we do?
But I, you know, if because some of these attacks, according to the articles, were affiliated with the Russian government. One can argue that the Russians could say, well, you're killing our economy right now. You're putting all this restriction on us. You already hurt us. You're already hurting us. So what more can we do? Especially, you know, as the more advanced, technically advanced cultures, societies that we have in the world, as we embrace more technology, we're also opening ourselves for such attacks. And other societies that may not be as technically using the technology in their everyday usage. I think of North Korea, for example, right? I don't know much about North Korea, Jerry, all right? But I would venture to say they don't have a lot of iPhones there. The public doesn't have a lot of iPhones, right? That can get on TikTok or whatever. But that is just the nature of the beast for us. The more technology we embrace on our everyday use, the more we're always going to be exposed to these things. I just don't think there's a way out.
Yeah, it gives us an asymmetric risk profile.
Correct.
Yeah. But Sunil, you brought up the concept of whether, of what's an act of war in the context of me kind of asking for a solution to ransomware. So playing that out, let's say this is an act of war overtly, right? Oh yeah, we think this is there's enough substantiation, or at least they've looked the other way, so in Russia, that caused impact into NHS here. So what's next? You know, what's the appropriate retaliation for that? If it even is an act of war, like cruise missile strike against something.
cruise missile strike is something that what. I don't know how many things we can do that won't be escalatory, but wouldn't be commensurate, right? Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what would be commensurate? Let's just say, for the NHS attack, okay, 100 people die. Okay, well, what's the commensurate penalty or punishment that we need to enact, because that has a life and death, sure, consequences, right? That's been the main deterrent, not deterrent, but main holdback for cyber attacks. Well, who died? Okay. Well, guess what? People have died. People will die. And even like the during COVID, when attackers were hitting hospitals, patient care declined and people did die. It was indirectly, but still, it happened. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have the wherewithal to go and do something about it. And so now that's where we are. So going back to your comment about ransomware, well, it's because we continue to permit people to pay ransoms that we have this epidemic of ransomware. Well, let me just take that same notion and say we let people do these things that causes people to die, and people die, and we're not doing anything. So if you wanted to stop it, then you have to do something about people dying.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's interesting. If you think about that Rubicon of attacking hospitals. You know, people always, there was a point where people said, like, with ransomware operators, like, wow, that, you know, they have no honor at all. They've gone beyond that. Is that limited just to actors that feel like they're in a war theater or acting on behalf of a government? And is the average organized crime syndicate that has no such compunction going to honor that and say, okay, no, we're just going to go after CDK, the auto dealer? And if so, it is some kind of act of war, you know, narrative that plays out, just going to solve just a healthcare thing, but leave this massive epidemic of ransomware otherwise still on the table?
I think it's important, first of all, for hospitals and us to actually acknowledge the fact that people have died as a result of this. That itself should sit heavily on the people who committed the attack. Because a lot of people, you may know, well, you know, there's a lot of attacker profiles and psychological, you know, profiles of many of these attackers. And they oftentimes don't think, oh, no one's going to get harmed. We're just stealing money from big, rich corporations. But what if people actually do die?
Yeah.
You know, I like to think of it as kind of All these things kind of reminds me of ARPA, but in a negative way, right? Like, the government got involved in ARPA. It helped us with, you know, things that we didn't see benefits right away, but eventually it benefited society overall, right? We benefited from the internet, from microwaves, everything.
Yeah, you mean in the creation of the internet.
One could argue the same thing is happening with ransomware. The Russian government, the North Korean government, especially the Russian government, is building these tools, educating these future attackers, and coming out with new techniques that eventually become kind of part of the whole culture of attackers, right? So it was new when the Russian government used it, but then more attackers have been using that technology, and now they're you know, they're now picking on things like CDK. So to me, it's kind of like the ARPA, but of the anti-ARPA model.
It's the incubator.
Yeah.
Let me play this. So imagine you go back 18 months and we, the United States Department of Treasury, had banned ransom payments, however the mechanics were of that. And, you know, some would argue that today we would have the same amount of ransom, except now you'd have the CDKs of the world throwing their hands up and saying, hey, look at this awful legislation. I can't even pay the ransom. And as a result, I personally think that a CDK type thing just simply wouldn't have happened. Maybe I'm wrong. I just think those people that kept not getting paid would have moved on somewhere else. Now, in that environment, take the speculation that, let's say, that the Russian government is sanctioning or at least allowing these that are truly sabotage attacks. Because that's the contention here, is that the NHS attack is an example of a sabotage attack, and the extortion is just kind of a front. So we go to Sony Pictures. It's that kind of thing now. So if that's the case, ransomware is dead, no CDK, none of that. No, then all of a sudden we get somebody stealing the Federal Reserve data and doing something with it, or NHS is down and it's hurting patient care and it's attacking critical infrastructure. It would seem like that'd be really clear if there's no more ransom going on, and these attacks, the ones that still happen, seem to me like they'd be falling through a filter and be super clear, clearly identified as sabotage attacks, making it easier for attribution and counterattacks and everything else.
So one quick comment is that let's put ransomware in context with many other forms of very lucrative attacks, like BEC, for example. I forget the exact numbers, but I'm pretty sure BEC dwarfs ransomware in terms of monetary damages or monetary outflows. We lose a lot more money to BEC than we do to ransomware. Back in the day when we started to see internet commerce kick into high gear, there was a lot of things that we did to try to stop fraud in different channels and whatever else it is. But and it seemed like we were being successful and defeating these fraudsters and doing all these other sort of things. But we only looked at one particular statistic and saw these numbers go down without looking at the bigger picture of seeing all these other numbers go up. And other forms of fraud, other forms of stealing money. The fraudsters never went away. They just refocused their attention on other ways to make money. And so the question here is, okay, so we ban ransomware payments. I would bet we're going to see a lot more BEC. I mean, we already see a lot of BEC, but we're going to see even more, right? Because that's where the fraudster will still find a way to make money in some way or another.
I would agree with Sunil. I think once the funnel... Let's say we outlaw paying ransomware. Great, fine. You think those people are not going to continue to look for ways to make money, like Sunil said? There's so many mom and pop utility companies in the United States that can just fall. Like, all it would take is, hey, North Korean government, the Russian government, the Chinese government will pay you. They have a fund. They have an angel investment fund. I'm going to do an angel investment fund for doing damage to my enemies. And not just the United States. You got the whole EU. You got countries in Africa. These folks are not going to, just because a commercial company or, you know, public company is not going to pay you money. They're going to go to the government sector, and they're going to get money. Maybe it might not be as lucrative, but it's going to pay the bills tomorrow for these attackers.
Yeah.
Another way to think about it, and this is a really perverse way of thinking about it, but these ransomware gangs are consultants that are helping you find your security vulnerabilities and exacting a very specific price for helping you understand how to fix your security vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and you know, on a related note, I was thinking about this. The ransom that is calculated, but certainly that is paid, is always something that is payable, right? No one's spending more money than they have, which means it's free margin. But I would argue in an altruistic sense that that's all funding that should have been going towards innovation, towards R&D. And that's what the true victim of ransomware.
Hold on, wait a second. Let me. This is self-deprecating because I used to be a consultant. But you know, we spend a lot of money on consultants as well. Okay, and I'm not sure if that's. I'm not sure which is more productive.
getting
a report from a consultant that says, "Here's the things you need to fix," or getting a report from a ransomware attacker that says, "Oh, here's exactly what you need to fix," because that's how I get in.
You know what this reminds me of? Using your example, Sunil, of cattle. This is like mad cow disease, right? Like you're basically having these attackers. You know, they're consultants. They're destroying your stuff, but making you better in the end. It's like, this is the worst kind of mad cow disease happening to us.
Well, I think that the natural progression of all this is bug bounties, right? I mean, that's the perfect.
It's a more sanctioned way of doing it. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, without the ransom involved. All right, guys, another topic that's come up. We have, you know, yet another week, another CVE here with this MOVEit vulnerability. And I never owned a MOVEit system during the years that it was popped and all of that through luck, right? But it reminds me a lot of Ivanti, right? And the idea that with Ivanti, there's been serial, sequential, massive issues. And my take on that is that it's because it had very weak architecture that was hidden. It was a black box, but which meant only the bad guys could get to it. I don't know if that's the case here. Is this a fundamental issue and it keeps on coming back, or is it just kind of random?
Yeah, no, this one, I don't know if I'll call it. It is more random in that the specific vulnerability was actually really hard to find, and it's definitely not a no-brainer vulnerability. There are a couple of interesting takeaways from this one. No static analysis would have ever found this. It only happened because of this interaction between this particular SSH module and MOVEit itself. And so you could statically analyze both sets of code and never find anything. It's the interaction between them that caused the issue. And finding that interaction, and it's a very narrow type of interaction that occurred that resulted in the vulnerability. So finding it, I mean, it would have been really hard. In fact, whoever found it, it required effort.
You're trying to avoid giving kudos to some criminal, right?
we don't know who found it yet, whether it was Progress or some external researcher. But there was something that came out of it that I wanted to focus on, which is, it got disclosed. So news about it came out before it was supposed to be more widely distributed, and meaning that attackers got wind of this through some mechanism. We're not sure exactly what, but the point is that this was embargoed, and the communication mechanism of a really really sensitive vulnerability became something that we should really think about. Like, what is it that we want? We want people to know that, hey, you really need to patch this thing. Here's the patch. Here's what's going to happen, and here's when it's going to drop. All that kind of stuff. And something happened where it leaked, and attackers got ahead of the game because of that. So the question really is, okay. And this is not about MOVEit. This is more about, like, what do we do next when we have a high severity vulnerability? Progress was trying to do the right thing by letting customers know, hey, you got to fix this thing. And I think they tried to do the most as much as they could. They made the vulnerability announcement less severe sounding because they didn't want the attackers to gain wind of it. But at the end of the day, it was a pretty significant vulnerability, and the right people needed to know about it, and we didn't want the wrong people to know about it ahead of time. So is there a better way to communicate this out because whatever way that was used, something leaked and didn't give us the time that we needed.
Yeah, I think when you have something internally discovered like that, I've seen it. People try to institute a waterfall, if you will, of trusted circles of who they're going to let know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it in critical infrastructure. You get a briefing on something, and we're not going to tell the general public for a week. And then, of course, they rush and have to tell everybody a day later because leak is not even the right word. It's just people will kind of telegraph that there's a vulnerability. If you tell 20 critical infrastructure companies, they've got a lot of researchers. They've got a lot of security people. They all run and start poking around in their own systems, and people notice that. And so it kind of gets telegraphed out that something's going on there. The good news, I think, is kind of the opposite is true as well. I remember with Log4j, for example, there was a race to kind of reverse engineer the announcements and figure out how to compromise what was out there. And I do remember that the scanning activity from malicious actors, once they figured out how to exploit that, did not arrive any sooner than the same from security researchers and bug bounties, which was awesome. And that was a watershed moment to me, that because of the financial motivations and bug bounties, that people were actually looking for these things just as fast as adversaries, which is what you have to do in order to allow the end user companies to actually notice something's going on without getting popped.
I think it's challenging. Well, first of all, I think I agree with all of you. Once somebody knows, we will all know. I mean, honestly, within 24, 48 hours,
yeah,
the community is going to hear about it. Okay, it's just going to come out. I could see why folks are, where it would be challenging to share this kind of information is if there's no patch available yet or a compensating control that can buy you time. I mean, how many of us can just say, oh, I'm not going to use, I'm not going to be able to use this tool, take it down, not using it, even if it's core critical to my business. Mm-hmm. I don't know, guys. I don't know if we could do that. I mean, I know we've all had these kind of conversations in the mm-hmm. past, but so I think I kind of in between. You do need, once this information, once somebody knows about it, everybody's going to know about it relatively quickly. And even if you're trying to stall for time because you don't have a solution, I think in the end, you just have to know that everybody's going to know.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. As usual, it's a real pleasure chatting with you guys. And with any luck, there will be absolutely no news, and we'll have nothing to talk about next time. But I have a feeling that won't be the case. Yeah. But otherwise, I hope you guys have a great holiday, and look forward to catching up soon.